Good morning, everybody from San Francisco. Good afternoon if you're in Europe. I'm delighted to be here. FIFF is very near and dear to me. And I'm glad to be with these two individuals, with Jim McGregor, who is the chair of Greater China for APCO Worldwide, a former journalist with the Wall Street Journal and author of two familiar books on the topic of this morning. Despite their long titles, I might say, No Ancient Wisdom, No Followers, The Challenges of Chinese Authoritarian Capitalism is one of Jim's books. And then the one I'm particularly familiar with, 1 Billion Customers, Lessons from the Front Lines of Doing Business in China. Jim is joined by Andy Rothman, an investment strategy with Matthews Asia and principal responsibility for the San Francisco Investment House's research on China's political economy. He writes a highly respected column, monthly column, Sinology, that's published on the Matthews Asia website. Between the two of them, they've spent more than a half a century in Hong Kong and on mainland China. Although they join us today, Andy from the Bay Area in California, and Jim from upstate Minnesota, where he's been sheltering since the pandemic's outbreak in China, planning to return to Shanghai as soon as that makes sense. We're truly, truly fortunate to have these two very thoughtful people on the China scene, observers of the China scene and of the U.S.-China relationship, especially given their perspectives on the outlook for business and investment in Asia. As we all know, it's a deeply troubling time under any and all circumstances, but it's even more troubling given the critical nature of this relationship between the world's two largest economies. What that leadership in each country does and says, their actions and the directions they take, has enormous implications at home, as well as for global growth and sustainability. And it seems as if these tensions in the U.S.-China relationship are increasing almost daily, with the latest front opening in the U.S.-China tech wars. First, the campaign against Huawei, and now the fallout from President Trump's executive order banning the U.S. use of TikTok and WeChat. All totaled, it's fair to say that the bans are now part of a campaign that has been broadened to include trade, espionage, national security, and the pandemic. It's also fair to note that all this is unfolding against a challenging backdrop in each of the two countries. In the U.S., there's a highly contentious presidential election that is now kicking into high gear, with the party conventions behind us, an American electorate that is deeply, deeply divided, and the pandemic continues to hold the economy captive. In China, Xi Jinping is tightening his hold on power, while the economy is showing signs of springing free of COVID's tentacles. The government is recalibrating how it deals with domestic concerns as well as international political hostility. Meanwhile, China cannot be making many international friends with its actions on the India border, in the South China Sea, and in Hong Kong. How will Xi thread the domestic and the international needle, particularly when it comes to keeping foreign business and investment engaged in China, and the current uncertainties in the relationship and geopolitically prompting business and investors to rethink their China investments or their confidence in the Chinese market? What can we expect come November 4th, the day after the presidential election in the U.S.? We'll hear from Andy on the outlook for the U.S.-China relationship, and then from Jim for his take inside China. Each will take just about 5 minutes, maybe a little less, and then we'll go to Q&A. And as Marcin pointed out, at the halfway point, we'll go off the record. So I'll turn it over to Andy and then to Jim, please. Thank you.
Thanks, Marcia, and thanks for OnFIFF for hosting this. Great introduction, although commenting that Jim and I have spent a combined half century in China is making me feel really old. Most of that time must have been Jim then. So before I get on to U.S.-China relations, let me make a couple of quick points about two other issues that are important to all of us, and that's COVID and the Chinese economic recovery that Marcia alluded to. COVID is probably the most important thing for understanding what's going on in China and also U.S.-China relations, because as we know, the virus was first detected there, possibly started in bat caves in Yunnan. But more importantly, for the moment, China seems to have COVID under control. As of last night, there were only about 300 Chinese COVID patients in hospital, That's down from 58,000 in February at the peak. There hasn't been a COVID-related death in China since the middle of April. And then that has allowed the economy to come back, having COVID under control. So we've seen through July, 5 consecutive months of a V-shaped recovery, including strong double-digit year-over-year sales growth in things like automobiles, new homes, and also online goods sales. So the economy is clearly bouncing back. These two points are really important for understanding U.S.-China relations for a variety of reasons that I'll go into now. But one of them is that despite a pretty aggressive approach by the Trump administration, the responses from Xi Jinping and his government have been quite modest and I think designed not to escalate the problems. But let's look at where we are today and how we got here. Let's go back in history. But don't worry, I'm not going to talk about 5,000 years of Chinese history. I'm going to leave that to Jim. I just want to go back to January, about 7 months ago. President Trump said in January that U.S.-China relations were better than they had ever been. He said he and Xi Jinping were in love with each other. His national security advisor, Robert O'Brien, said, yeah, there's a lot of problems between the U.S. and China. We have a lot of different perspectives, but there's a great opportunity, he said, to work together. 7 months later, look at where we are now. But where are we right now? Things have gotten worse consistently. Relationship is terrible. It is almost certainly going to continue to get worse every week between now and November 3rd. So let's just stipulate that and talk about what might happen after November 3rd. Let's start with if President Trump is reelected to his second term. I would say that there's a 50-50 chance that things continue to get worse every week, like they have been since the beginning of COVID. But there's also a 50% chance that things get better. Because why has the relationship become so bad just since January? Well, obviously it's because of COVID. And I think it's because the president has decided that a focal point of his campaign is to deflect blame for his mishandling of COVID in the United States onto China. We could see that in his speech last night accepting the Republican nomination. He mentioned China frequently. In fact, it was the only country other than Israel that mentioned more than once. But what was most interesting to me was what the president did not say about China. He didn't use his Secretary of State's language about China presenting an existential threat to America, about China wanting to end the American way of life and interfere in American democracy. He didn't say anything about that. He didn't say anything about Huawei. He didn't mention TikTok. He didn't mention Xinjiang or Taiwan or Hong Kong. So from that, we can infer that those issues probably don't matter so much to the president. In fact, he's rarely mentioned any of those things before. And Xi Jinping might be the one world leader who President Trump hasn't criticized or mocked on Twitter. So it's possible, because the only things he mentioned in the speech were about bringing jobs back from China. It's possible that if he wins a second term, he'll go back to where things were before COVID, which is not a great relationship, not a constructive relationship in my view, not one that will lead China to make progress on the issues that we should be caring about, but one that's much less confrontational and contentious than today. But of course, there's also a 50-50 chance that he'll continue to allow the rest of his administration to move on the issues that we're all familiar with over the last several months. Now, if Vice President Biden wins, I think there'll be a significant change, but we also need to be realistic. It's not going to be a dramatic change, certainly not in the first year of his presidency, where he's going to have to focus primarily on COVID and getting the economy back again. But if you look at what Biden's campaign has published and what his advisors have been saying, I think the big change will be to try and have a collaborative, coordinated approach towards China with the U.S.'s main allies. And this is really important because one of the reasons that what President Trump has done so far has had little impact on China is it's been focused on sanctions, on tariffs. But a lot of people seem to forget that China is no longer an export-led economy. Over the last 5 years, on average, net exports contributed zero to China's GDP growth. And on top of that, last year, the U.S. took only 17% of China's exports. So having a coordinated, collaborative approach, deciding what the key issues are that we can work with China on collaboratively and where we need to put pressure on them jointly will, I think, be a big change from what we've been seeing now. So with that, let me pass it back to Marcia.
Okay. Well, Andy, thank you. Thank you very much. I was making a note or two here as you were talking, and just briefly, you've talked about the economy coming back. President Xi having tempered his response to President Trump and the what's happening out of the U.S. The economy is making a turn. You didn't say a V-shaped recovery, but perhaps a V-shaped recovery. And that the tensions in the relationship mark are a distinct change from what they were 7 months ago. And then you talked about the difference in the relationship with China from the U.S. perspective, if Trump is in for another 4 years or if Biden is elected. Let's go to Jim from there and get a sense for your perspective, Jim, from you're not inside China at the moment, but having been inside China and worked long inside China. So please take it from here.
Yeah, thank you. I'm in Minnesota because of the virus. So I can't get back to China now, but I still live in Shanghai. The way I look at this is we're in a situation where Chinese overreach versus American underperformance. China kind of had America where they wanted us, you know, from a business community perspective. China could hack American corporations, take their technology, and those companies would go to the USTR or Treasury or Commerce and say, I'm really mad about this. And U.S. government say, what should I do about it? And they say, don't do anything. I'd want to mess up my China market share. But with Made in China 2025, and with closing of the economy more and more where Chinese companies could do it, the business community got pretty fed up. And the overreach just kind of pushed them. Everybody was going to push back. Hillary would have pushed back in a much smarter way than Trump has. But the pushback was coming. And so where we sit now, China now is on both a bit of defense and some offense. Defensively, hunkering down in its economy for long-term hostility. Xi Jinping has this new theory that he came out with in May that is now getting a lot of talk called dual circulation. And essentially what it means is looking at the outside world and looking at China and stepping back and recalibrating both of them. Because China's got all these connections all over the world with all these organizations, all these financial connections, business connections. They're stepping back and they're looking at all of that. And they're saying, how do we redo this for our own good and for where we can build our domestic economy and domestic demand to support us and not be dependent on external demand where we can't control it? And so they're even talking about self-sufficiency in agriculture and energy, which I find would be virtually impossible for China to do, given it's got a very small percentage of its land is arable, and it doesn't, the rocks have not been good to China. They don't have a lot of energy resources. But it also is about, if you're a foreign company, if you are doing something China needs and is good for China, you're probably going to have some pretty good market openings, whether that's technology, high-end manufacturing, the components for that, or if you're a big box retailer and you provide low-cost quality goods to Chinese consumers that will help encourage by Chinese consumers. This is also they're going to double down on their industrial policies, import substitution. And what I worry about this is I think the foreign companies will welcome having more access in China if that's what this turns out to be. But then 5 years down the road, if these people have quite significant market share in China, will they go back to the old days of pushing it back against any U.S. or European pushback against Chinese policies? And will China then get a political grip on these foreign companies? Xi Jinping himself is going through an interesting period. Well, first off, that's all going to be put into the 14th five-year plan that'll be coming out next year. That's a key part of the plan. Xi Jinping is now getting ready for his third term, which he gets because he removed term limits that Deng Xiaoping put in. That made people across the board in China pretty unhappy, even though in this very repressive atmosphere, it's pretty hard for them to say anything about it. But he's approaching that. And so there's a lot going on right now to tighten down the place, to get better control, to put out a positive message that China's making a comeback. We're making China great again, but the whole world is against us and we are victims. I'll leave it at that.
Great. Well, thank you, Jim. So you're really describing in a very broad brush the situation with China, one of overreach internationally, I would gather, and for the U.S., one of underperformance on a couple of fronts. The situation in China is where they are taking the offensive and trying to button things down within China, even pushing forward with this under this new rubric of dual circulation, where they emphasize the self-sufficiency in key industries, but still have relationships internationally, but for the benefit of their domestic economy. And then Xi himself, in a very interesting period as the country looks forward to coming up with a new five-year plan, and I think that's 2022. and so we're at an interesting period, interesting inflection point with the leadership in China, as well as Andy was pointing out with the U.S. I wonder if we might stay with that point just for a moment, the U.S. presidential election, the leadership situation in the U.S. and the leadership situation in China. I wonder if the two of you might address the relationship between Xi in his third term and a President Trump in his second term, or a President Biden in his first term. And Andy, you might try to draw those distinctions for us, building on what you said in your opening remarks.
As I mentioned at the beginning, I think that the Xi Jinping administration has gone out of its way to avoid escalating the tensions between the two sides. But it's also very likely that that has a timeline attached to it, which is November 3rd, or possibly January 20th. If President Trump wins a second term, I think there'll still be a period of caution on the part of Xi Jinping to see what Trump will do in the coming years with respect to his China policy. Will he continue to be as confrontational and aggressive as he's been in the last several months, or will it go back to where it was before, where I think the Chinese thought that they had outmaneuvered President Trump? So I think we'll see caution. But if the U.S. approach to China under a second Trump administration continues to be as confrontational as it has been in recent months, I think there's a high probability that the Chinese response will be just as aggressive and confrontational in the other direction. And I think what the focus will be on is trying to split America away from its allies and closest partners. One of the things that we have to remember is that most of our NATO allies do more trade with China than they do with the United States, which is also the case for countries like Japan and Australia and New Zealand. These are countries that do not want to be put in the position of having to choose sides in a black and white confrontation between the United States or China. They want to have constructive relations with both. And I think that's going to be the wedge issue for China if there's a second Trump administration and if they proceed down this confrontational path.
And what about under a Biden administration?
Well, they'll have to be pretty patient, because I think it'll take some time for the Biden administration to flesh out its approach. For example, I think it's unrealistic to expect that while Biden believes that the tariffs have been counterproductive, I don't think he'll be able to lift them quickly. My expectation will be that during the course of the first year, the focus will be not so much on talking to China, but on talking to our allies and partners and coming up with a collaborative, coordinated approach, highlight the issues that all these countries are concerned about, and pick a handful of them to push back hard on China, and then also find ways to work collaboratively on the issues where we have common interests, like climate change. Mm-hmm. So it'll take some time for that to play out, and then we'll have to see how the Chinese deal with this. For example, you know, sometimes they're their own worst enemy. Wang Yi, the foreign minister, was in Norway yesterday, and in response to a question at a press conference with the Norwegian foreign minister standing next to him, said, well, if the Nobel Committee was to award a prize to political dissidents in Hong Kong, that would basically destroy China relations with Norway. You know, that's not exactly the kind of way you want to approach countries that are trying to navigate this problem.
Thank you, Andy. So, Jim, Andy gave us an international perspective on that. Could you come inside China on that same question, but also address the outlook of the economy and issues with fiscal policy, with monetary policy. Could you bring that into the picture? And I might just add your reflecting back on your earlier comments about Xi Jinping and the administration, the government really focusing down on the domestic economy, taking his plan forward of greater self-sufficiency in key areas of the economy, key sectors, particularly in the technology sector, my take. But if you would give us your perspective on either on the Chinese perspective on either a Trump administration number two or a Biden administration, and then bring in aspects of the economy. We had a question from somebody in the audience having to do with the Chinese economy and its funding, its fiscal policies. Could you please give us your sense?
Well, when it comes to economics, Andy is the economist. What I see from the business community on the ground is that things are going pretty well right now. Covered quite well. The supply chains are intact. Travel is almost back to normal. Business people are going around the country doing normal business. People are without masks in many places. And also because global demand has gone down, more and more companies are looking to the China market to give them a bit of a boost they need because the rest of the world is not working for them right now very well. As far as the international relations aspect of this and what went on in Norway yesterday, it's I think China decided if you can't be loved, you might as well be feared. And there's this, because we used to look at it and say, okay, China's trying to make the world safe for their system. And Xi Jinping has said this. Okay, we respect your democracy. Why can't you respect us? But as I'll quote Liz Economy recently, she said, it's an illiberal power going out into the world to have control of a liberal system. And it's the incompatibility of that. So now they've got these wolf warrior diplomats going around insulting people and, it's really counterproductive. And I think it's not unlike Trump. You know, half the people in the Trump administration, whenever they open their mouth, they're talking to Trump and trying to look good for Trump. I think it's the same thing with Xi because he's all powerful. He's put all power in his own hands. He's put it all in the party and at the top. And so I think a lot of people are talking up to him and who knows what he actually knows. But I can tell you, I'll tell you a conversation I had with some Chinese officials in November, December last year. And this was retired cabinet level people, ministers. And they were very confident. And they were saying, look, America couldn't handle our system when we were a smaller economy. Now that we're such a big economy, we knew we would have this fight. We are ready for it and we are together. In America, you can't beat something with nothing. Countries and companies are going to have to just adapt to being, to fit in with us, to get along with us. China was very good at playing an empty hand. Zhou Enlai did a pretty good job with Kissinger on the initial negotiations. But once China got powerful and with a full hand, they can't play a full hand. And they've really hurt themselves all over the world. And it just keeps mounting and mounting and mounting. And now the view in China is that we are victims and the world's out to get us. And they're building that up, not unlike what Trump is doing in America, that we're victims of China stealing our jobs. So everybody's stuck in victims and villains. Meanwhile, the business community is trying to maneuver the best they can because the China market is extremely important for the top American and European companies. Whether it's the auto companies, chips, any kind of technology, the China market is, if they don't have the China market, they're going to lose out globally. And so there's this trying to survive walking through a minefield every day is what the business does.
Thank you to Amfif, but thank you especially to Andy Rothman and Jim McGregor, really for lending us your good thoughts and your insights and your time. Thanks very much and keep reading Amfif.